This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Sleep deprivation is the worst. Okay. That game.
All right, so you're on now.
Can I start from the top?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts, the better to understand how society works. Each week, Fuad and I will discuss a concept or a classic text, perhaps. We hope we'll shed light on the world around you. And because this week is Merdeka Week, we're going to look at the question of colonialism, post-colonialism, recolonization,
decolonization,
a whole range of things.
The whole colonial discourse, I think that's one way we can summarize it.
So how do we begin? I mean, what does it even matter to Malaysians, you think, in a week like this when people celebrate independence? Is there a kind of theoretical dimension to some of these issues?
I think it's a bit inevitable, right? I mean, when we talk about Merdeka, we use rather heavy and abstract concepts like the nation, like progress, freedom, liberation. And often we don't really pause to reflect on what they should mean. I mean, I'm sure you've noticed this as well, because you studied based for your API fellowship, intellectual networks, and the discourse used to be much richer, but now it's just become full of, you know, trite truisms and cliches.
That might be, I think, perhaps because the idea of nation building as a specifically kind of state-led project has demanded that governments take on the worst aspects of public relations, the worst lessons of branding, to in order to kind of push the idea or to make present in the minds of people what in some ways is a rather abstract idea of the nation. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have passports, so you know when you cross, you come to a certain point, you have to cross a border, and that marks the end of or the terminal point of the nation state before another border begins or another state begins. But the idea, not just that there is something called Malaysia and one operates within it with its laws, but that one has to love the nation. I think that is probably the most difficult. What does it mean, and what does the love of nation and patriotism actually mean in sociological terms?
Well, I agree. Those are very interesting topics. What do you make of that? Why do people get so defensive about the idea of the nation? I was thinking about this question in light of what happened 2 years ago when Mat Sabu made that comment about how Bukit Kepong was actually an attack against the colonizers and not really the sanctified narrative of liberation that we often recall it as. So it somehow can evoke passions. The notion of independence can get people really defensive about their identity. What's behind that?
Well, you know, some people argue that it's somehow a primordial impulse, that somehow in all of us is a patriot waiting to be born, you know, that what we saw in the Balkans, the bloody massacres, the tearing apart of nations based on, you know, ethnic identities was really that which is that underscores all this. But I think, in fact, in many ways, patriotism is a practice. It is produced by specific institutions, our schools, state media, forms of governance that really demand that we continually remember. And in fact, it's precisely because so much is looking at the process, in the investment of energy and materials in trying to get us to remember that we are Malaysians, that marks the true ephemeral and fabricated nature of the nation state. Mm-hmm. That if it was so real, we wouldn't have to be told on a daily basis to love the nation.
Yeah, the way that it's often celebrated comes across like we're all trying to compensate for not being, you know, for not being nationalistic enough, you know, so we have to re-emphasize and remind ourselves that we are Malaysians, that we are united, that there is this single uniting coherent narrative that binds us all. So who gains from all this? Is this just power play from the top, or is it just random, arbitrary pathos being expressed?
Well, I think if you think of the work of sociologists that have employed, you know, historical methodologies to understand the trajectory of human societies, one is to recognize, of course, that the nation state is a fairly new entity, and that its future is by no means guaranteed. It emerged at a particular historical point. It might disappear, right? I mean, that's the promise for some. That is the nightmare for others. But the nation state is a particular response to the world and to conditions that have emerged in the world. So for me, what we see in patriotism really is the cultural logic of this other thing that's happening. The organization of economy, the organization of political mobilization requires a kind of cultural correlate. And that cultural correlate is, patriotism, mm-hmm. The focus on nation, all these things, right? Mm-hmm. So, national cinema, that celebrates the nation.
National literature, yeah.
Literatures. I mean, yeah. these are cultural expressions that are matched to those political and economic structures. So that's how I think it kind of operates together.
It's ironic and tragic at the same time to see how independence, narrative independence, is celebrated as a liberation from colonialism when in fact it was the colonial project that created the nation state in the first place.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it, right? Because I think it can and has been argued that the response to colonialism was in fact in many ways to take on the deeper logic of the colonial project of a Western concept of the individual, of society, of the state, and to kind of use it against the colonial powers by saying, well, actually, we could be as good as you,
right,
but on your terms. Mm-hmm. And so the question of the anti-colonial movement wasn't necessarily a post-colonial one, meaning it wasn't going to graduate to some other logic. Mm-hmm. It wasn't going to inscribe some other cultural sense of community, that it was in fact going to stand among as an equal, mm-hmm. by mimicking its former masters.
Is that what's happening to Malaysia right now, Sharad? Do you think we have just reinforced the colonial logic? I mean, let's look at how Malaysia has become embedded in the global capitalist system. I mean, we're now dependent on foreign direct investment. Not only are we exploiting the cheap labor from neighboring countries, we're also exploiting cheap labor of local workers. I mean, there are malls everywhere now eating up public space. I mean, it seems like if the British came and planted the seeds of capital, we have just gladly sowed it. I mean, am I being hyperbolic here? I mean,
yeah,
how would you
maybe
look at
though
it?
Maybe the way to think about it is, is that the British came because capital was moving. You know, the British themselves are not necessarily the agents, that in some sense all nations and, the British as purveyors of this, of a particular form of capitalism or are being the flagship, as it were, mm-hmm. of a particular kind of imperialism, really were part of this larger flow. I mean, they themselves, I mean, I think about, the way in which my ancestors came to this part of the world. I mean, I am the symptom of that logic, that pushed, as capital sought to find new markets, as resources and there were labor requirements, my ancestors were caught up in those flows as mm-hmm. well. And so, for me, it's not so much about rejecting colonialism as some sort of wretched moment in history, but really recognizing what history means, and wanting on one hand to assert agency, and I think that's our essentially our power to determine our fate in the face of these large structures that are in some ways quite anonymous, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we might call it British, but the British themselves are a symptom of those large structures of, mm-hmm, you know, of economy and labor and resources that are swirling, you know, internationally. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean, really, at the end of the day, you know? The malls are just a particular expression. I don't know if they're necessarily something one needs to rail against, you know. They're easy targets, as the British are easy targets, mm-hmm, you know.
But the deeper structural patterns that you have to think about here, especially if we really want to take those categories of progress, freedom more seriously, it seems like that's, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what's your sense? I mean, say, okay, so now you can, in the way in which the national narratives are written, you're part of that indigenous community. So I'm kind of non-indigenous. you're indigenous, so you can make claims to that indigeneity. But what does indigeneity actually mean in the making of something like that category we call Malay?
Well, I mean, where does one even begin, right? I think that's the problem, you know, the idea that indigeneity even has to be protected is interesting when seen in this light, right? It seems that it cannot stand by itself, or its epistemic coherence must continually be reinforced by institutions. Shows that it's a more fluid category than people like to think. And I think this too is one of those tragic outcomes of the colonial logic that's been extended in the quote-unquote post-colonial period, where the categories that the colonial system used, the racial attitudes that the colonial system bred, are somehow inherited even by the regimes after. I think one of the interesting things that we can look to now in hindsight is how, in a way, the liberation project has taken an interesting turn, in that while Malaysia was not a part of we did not end up part of the Eastern Bloc, right? It became infused in the capitalist system. It somehow has an interesting position to look at history with, right? Because we know that the Soviet experiments in Southeast Asia turned out to be a disaster. Right. So we are somehow able to see that, okay, this is the path we do not want to go. But at the same time, we are also witnesses to the brutality of capitalism, to see that, well, this is also not the way we want to go. So the damages that have been done to us was severe. I don't want to downplay it. But I think in rethinking the narrative of independence, narrative of progress, we are in a good position to think of alternatives beyond the typical binary that defined the Cold War period, that really engulfed the region.
Yeah, I mean, I think you put your finger on one of the key pivots of that time, of the 50s and 60s, when many of the countries are decolonizing, was that it was a world cleaved in half by the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And of course, subsequently, the Soviet-China split did make models and options, that much more difficult, because you had these ideological schisms, as it were, in the left. But I'm reminded of the struggles in Western Europe following the end of the World War, when there was a need to, some on the part of, say, Western powers, to wean European intellectuals off things like historical materialism, this idea that, you know, there was a progressive unfolding of history, that we were moving that, and that somehow, you know, the Soviet Union or the left was the future, right? Mm-hmm. And you had cultural vehicles, mostly in the form of intellectual magazines and opinion, magazines of opinion and culture that were produced across the world, including in Southeast Asia, to promote a particular idea of what the future was going to be like. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could speak more about this, mm-hmm. you know, as, you know, we can speak more about this in the second part of the show. So perhaps this is a good time to pause and you're listening to Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, and this is BFM 89.9. Did that work?
Yeah, it worked. Just about 15 minutes. Okay. How was that? That was okay, right?
That was okay.
The conversation.
How was that?
Conversation. I liked it better than the first one.
Okay, great. Okay, that's good. That's good. At least we're making progress. Okay, so we return. Okay. BFM 89.9, I'm Sharad Kutin with Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. This is Night School, and it's Merdeka Week, and we're talking about the colonial experience and what maybe theory can, how theory can inform our understanding of independence, nationalism.
And all that.
And all that. All that good stuff. Now, one of the things, of course, is that that's been argued by theorists is that many countries that decolonized really got recolonized. Now, you didn't have political control, but you had economic control in terms of, especially in terms of trade relationships between, you know, the former metropolitan centers of the world
and the periphery,
and the periphery, and so you have, you have center and periphery. All these concepts were developed to understand what was really happening. That you know, independence didn't
liberate us.
Liberate in the ways that we thought it would necessarily, And so you know, what often is invoked, I guess, especially as Marxist scholars, is the idea of understanding that colonialism was really just a modality of imperialism. Mm-hmm. And imperialism being that that logic of capitalism and economic system needing to, you know, to expand, you know, whether it was in terms of finding new markets for products or sourcing cheap resources or drawing in cheap labor or into its production system. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, with the end of colonialism, we don't see the end of that system. The system continues. It's just got a different face to it. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, something that's even come up in the more recent discussions about the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade negotiations that have gone on and the warnings that have been issued by certain, you know, elder statesmen that we were going to be colonized again.
Yep.
And it's interesting. I mean, 50 years on, the idea that it would be so easy to, in fact, colonize us. And what has become of that feeling of empowerment that I think often is celebrated in the nationalist narratives that we have. So we think of, you know, at least for Malaya, the rise of UMNO or even the other political parties all coming together, the idea that a colonized people threw off the yoke of colonialism, rose up, took control of their nations and went forth. 56 years later, we tremble at the thought that a trade negotiation will return those shackles again. What's happened?
I mean, like you said, you know, the system has remained. And I think one element of that system, which is also wedded into the whole discourse of colonialism and post-colonialism, is the idea of cultural imperialism. The idea that even though the bureaucracies that upon which colonialism planted itself across its colonies may have changed, their culture, their outlook, their worldview remains, and in fact remains not only present but also dominant in the ways of thinking of the formerly colonized people. So yes, economic system enables the life and the growth of the capitalist system, but the cultural level of imperialism legitimizes it, or so the argument goes. And I think that's another interesting angle that the post-colonial studies takes as well as a point of departure.
One of the other things that perhaps that, you know, historians and theorists can help us do is to kind of deflate the ideological rhetorical quality of notions like you know, colonialism, because it obviously is bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how, you know, in kind of layman's terms, you know, the colonial period is bad. But really, what was going on then? You know, what in the decades and centuries that we were colonized, what really happened, and who was involved in it? Who was complicit, mm-hmm. especially of locals, of the non-colonialists? So you think, okay, so you have these bogeys of the white man, you know, the right. British imperialists, but who else made that system work? And I think when you start to, when, you know, historians remind us of how it actually worked,
mm-hmm.
That you, other things emerge, like the issues of class. Because clearly, within the non-European population, there were classes,
mm-hmm.
groups who worked hand in glove,
yes.
with the colonials.
There was already a primordial hierarchy of the haves and the have-nots. And when you consider how the British colonial enterprise started with only a few people, then you must wonder how these few people eventually got to the most of the country's resources. And it wasn't through their own hard work, because it happened really fast. So they must have had friends among the locals and the colonized.
And of course, you know, and that leads to theories of, you know, comprador capitalists. I mean, the whole kind of neo-Marxist, you know, theoretical enterprise.
The comprador being the fancy word for sellouts. Local sellouts.
or sellouts being the unnuanced word for comprador.
Yeah.
You know, basically, you know, you have not the simple categories of us and them,
yeah.
you know, the bad colonials against, you know, the oppressed indigenous. But mm-hmm. in fact, within the so-called native indigenous classes, mm-hmm. you have a real variety of mm-hmm. of interests. And that self-interest often... and competing interests often allowed these few colonials to come in and rule and divide and conquer and play one against the other. I mean, mm-hmm. they had perhaps more than a really brilliant sense of working native interests off each mm-hmm. other.
But one question that we can build on that observation that you shared, Sharad, is how... given even that the colonial project was nonetheless sustainable for a long period of time, and a lot of theorists point to the role of ideology in enabling that, and whereby the colonized essentially accept their inferiority before the colonials, and see how the colonial enterprise was legitimate. Right, religion was a very potent ideological weapon here. In that the colonials could frame the enterprise as one of salvation, one of saving the natives.
The civilizing mission.
Civilizing them, giving them education, giving them products, giving them access to markets, and so on and so forth. So, correct, there was a complicit class in most of these cases, but what we find as well was that there was a complicit populace that, for the most part, accepted that the presence of the colonial enterprise could be justified to be of some good. Of course, there were a lot of resistance at the same time, but the fact that the colonial project could last for hundreds of years meant that ideologically there was also strength in it, in the colonial presence.
Yeah, I think that, you know, we talked about this several episodes ago about the way in which the First World War really shook, at least among the intellectual classes of the Third World of Asia, a faith in the civilizing mission. Even while in the metropolitan centers, the intellectual class some segments of the intellectual class were suspicious of the rhetoric of empire. Right?
Mm-hmm.
I think of people like Ashish Nandi, who have written. And this is an Indian social theorist, you know, social psychologist, who's written about the self under colonialism and what becomes of the native's view of the world and his or herself in relation to colonial power. Aziv, could you run down and just tell them?
3A. We'll be done in like 10 minutes. We'll 10 be minutes. Done in less, even less
have
than
you
that. Yeah.
Paused it?
So we're at 24.
Have you paused it?
No. But
they're really just under us, right?
Record.
Yeah, so I think, you know, with Ashish Nandi, what you have is an attempt to think about you know, to not assume that things like the self and our relationship with the world or the political power, to even the, you know, the idea that democracy is somehow a good. I mean, I think Ashish Nandi is one of those critics of a particular logic that is in democracy of, you know, of numbers, the logic of numbers, you know, which in countries like as diverse as, say, India, can have appalling consequences mm-hmm. when a majority community thinks it can it has power, right, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and is mobilized on that basis. So, so for those who do not, I think, there's an intellectual tradition of not assuming that everything that was bequeathed to us by the colonial powers that were seen as progressive, you know, that was necessarily so, and that necessarily matched our situation. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's this other thing about whether, you know, in taking on Western forms of governance, we've actually transformed it mm-hmm. by a very different cultural logic. I mean, so there are all kinds of arguments about that, about the way these things fit. And for Malaysia, you know, I guess the issue is, do we look at the last 50 years and say, you know, what do we understand by the expectations that perhaps we had, you know, following independence? You know, there were arguments about increasing secularization, you know, mm-hmm. and that's been proven to be quite the opposite, right?
True.
There was modernization theory that was mm-hmm. huge in the 60s mm-hmm. and 70s, that's, you know, of which secularization is just one part of, one thematic concern mm-hmm. that, you know, has that there are a lot of questions around. So the question is, have the social sciences, you know, equipped us adequately with understanding our own experience?
That's a very fascinating question. I think, at least in academia, or even in pervading the intellectual discourses here, is the sense that the anti-colonial rhetoric has been largely overtaken by an Islamic approach to things. So they've taken the extreme perspective that the West, the ideas, the products, the way of life, except for its markets, right, is by and large a negative thing that should be rejected. And they use a lot of Islamic justifications against this, to the point of even saying that, well, you know, the human rights is a bad concept because it came from the West. Freedom, individual freedom is an illusion that the West promotes to strengthen its cultural hegemony, so on and so forth. So while you're right that we must approach the issue of colonialism and subsequently modernity very carefully, we have to also be wary of taking the extreme route of rejecting everything Western. And
This is an interesting thing, right? Is there, in fact, a way of engaging critically with that Western tradition that's, you know, in some ways ours, right? Mm-hmm. It is our history. But not necessarily seek in that a kind of like another totalizing system that's an alternative, right?
Right.
You know, it's that what is in fact productive is the critical engagement with that Western tradition, mm-hmm. and that itself is sufficient to build something and to tweak it, the system, to produce something that's more akin or adequate to our situation, without saying, oh, because it's bad, we reject it in toto and then we erect, you know, something in its place.
That demonstrates a real lack of creativity on those people's part, those people who adopt that position. But also, I think there must be a double move in that we must look at our own tradition very critically as well, not just hark to this to return to some idyllic past where things were great before the colonial project began. So I think it's a matter of intellectual finesse, right, in trying to balance engagement with the Western canon critically, seeing what's salvageable and what's not, but doing the same thing for our tradition as well. And this could apply to religion, this could apply to indigenous intellectual cultures, whatever. But I think the critical move is important.
Yeah. Two things that you mentioned. One is the look at what was before colonialism, mm-hmm. and how, you know, in recovering that sense of history, because the idea is that somehow during the colonial period, that history was diminished. Mm-hmm. That in trying to understand it, we don't give it a false value, you know, that we don't in fact see complexity in the pre-colonial, and that in also in recognizing the agency of the colonized, we and ascribing to it, you know, the power to resist, the power to think differently, the, you know, the power to renegotiate, we don't again fantasize about those classes of colonized and make them into something they weren't, you know. And maybe, you know, the post-colonial, I mean, there is a phrase used to describe the post-colonial as a kind of anticipatory discourse, meaning to recognize in the very term post-colonial something odd. It's about describing something that hasn't quite happened. So all this discussion about the colonial and what comes after the end of colonial governments, and we use a term that's in some ways wrong. It's it's because the post-colonial hasn't happened.
Right, right.
You know, we haven't, in fact transcended the colonial. And so it's, in that sense, an anticipatory discourse that we... But then the question is really, can we imagine what that post-colonial would be?
I think it would be, it would have to be some fusion of horizons, right? Horizon that's trying to come out of colonialism and a horizon that sees what the alternatives are. And I think this, in looking at that, certain personalities that went through that period are good indicators of what's possible or of the complexity that we have to keep in mind. I have in mind somebody like Shamsia Fakih, who I can't think of another figure who would be, you know, considered a radical Malay feminist before and after her, right? For never mind the position she took at that time as a woman in very difficult circumstances, but also what she did as a result, you know, taking up arms and fighting the colonial powers.
She was married to Ahmad Bostaman.
For a while. After that, they divorced shortly after, and then she married someone else. I can't remember who. But she was also an internationalist. She lived in Indonesia for a while, went to China, and there was this idea that, you know, there are horizons beyond the subjugation that colonialism forces upon you, and you must live a life of resistance. You know, sort of like what Camus said: live your life so freely as if every act is an act of resistance, act of rebellion. And I see that in Shamsia Fakih. You know,
this is interesting. So she's originally from Sumatra, isn't she?
Yeah, that's her lineage. Yeah,
right. And she
spent most of her life in Negeri Sembilan. Yeah,
yeah. And so, you know, I remember reading some time ago about that particular period, the 20s and 30s in Sumatra, and Gunawan Muhammad is, you know, Indonesian journalist and intellectual, and he talked about that time as a time of possibilities, you know, of kind of open horizons. I mean, and not to invoke the new brand for Malaysia, Endless Possibilities, but because that's something to do with, you know, whether I think really means endless opportunities. But the word possibility, as distinct from opportunity, is this thing, precisely the way in which identities at that point in time, so there you are a feminist, or at least you're a person who is focused on the question of the woman, in the life of the nation. You're an internationalist. You know, you cross borders. You take up arms. I mean, all that complex identities, which seem to be foreclosed for so many of us now living the life of the true Malaysia. We have, in fact, I think at this point, foreclosed possibilities rather than open them up.
Yes.
And that's somewhat tragic.
That's a lot to lament there, because I think now we're looking for that single identity that can fulfill us or something. We really ascribe into this kind of bourgeois middle class notion of personhood that is tied to a career, that's tied to a single set of religion or values, you know. Another character I think is fascinating as an example to accompany our discussion of Shamsia Fakih is Tan Malaka. Also, that's an internationalist, a revolutionary.
And Sumatran.
Sumatran as well. Incidentally.
He's Minang, right?
Polyglot, you know, had all these fascinating swashbuckling stories across Asia.
Yeah, he's the author of that very famous kind of travelogue, Dari Penjara ke Penjara. Mm-hmm. But, you know, and that's, you know, and this is a man whose intellectual ambitions, you know, were tremendous, right? Because he tries to meld dialectical materialism with some sort of indigenous knowledge forms, right? I think his famous book is Madilog or something like that, which I haven't read, you know. But, and it's perhaps to do in part with the whole Minangkabau worldview of the individual who has to relate to the outer world. There's the world
merantau,
of the...
Yeah.
And so merantau, the traveling, is about collecting knowledge to bring back to the alam, to your... Mm-hmm. So there is an outside and inside, but the outside and inside interact in this wonderfully dialectical and enriching, you know, a kind of way. And so I mean, this is my very crude reading of Tan Malaka. But
I think there's a lot to that. I think there's... In fact, it seems like we've just drifted into an answer for what...
Well, horizon. The future. So the future is the past.
But in such a way that you can never look at the past in the same way again, right? Because the idea of merantauing is to return home, but not as the same person, but not bringing back the same, not returning with the same things that you left with, but with more. But in richer ways, right? Culturally, so you don't see that borders are finite and rigid. So you don't see that differences are hindrances, but nonetheless freeing. And I think... those two figures that we've just coincidentally pointed out are rich examples.
I think, you know, in some ways, I mean, if there was going to be a kind of philosophical note to all this, it is that what those individuals represented was a kind of 20th century heroism. You know, this idea that, you know, the individual is there to not just expand his or her world, but to kind of move society along with them, right? It's very 20th century, as opposed to the rather limited horizons of, you know, endless opportunities or endless consumerism or, you know, right. I mean, you know, how many more...
Endless careerism,
you know, which it's so unambitious. But perhaps we're also, you know, cherry picking. We pick these exceptional individuals from that time. Mm-hmm. And we hold them as exemplars, perhaps a society that, for the main part, didn't produce, you know, produce much more ordinary people with much less ambition, right? Yeah. I mean, we're also kind of romanticizing this.
Yeah.
But it's a nice romance, you know?
But I don't think they were flawless, but I think they give out clues to... So certain cues we can take and how to look at life. Yeah.
And how that particular kind of society and time enabled those individuals to be, you know, that could we have a Shamsie Fakir today or tomorrow?
Don't get my hopes up, man. The question alone is like, you're making me wonder. But all right. So I think this is a time when we want to recommend some texts before we wrap up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, now that you mentioned it, I think, you know, Tan Malaka's, you know,
Dari Penjara. Yeah.
And there's a translation in English by Helen Jarvis that's available if you don't want to read the Indonesian version. But yes, because he travels through the region and around, and I think you do get a sense of a kind of an intellectual world that's borderless.
Yeah. And a selfhood that's borderless too.
What would you recommend?
Well, something unfortunately more academic is this book called Postcolonialism and Historical Introduction by Robert J.C. Young, published by Blackwell in 2001. And it basically gives a history of a lot of the stuff that we talk about, like colonialism, what it means, why it's important, how it's still relevant and all that. But through events in history.
Great. It's got a great cover. And there's a woman in a purdah and a young man wearing some sort of army outfit. Is this Turkey?
This is Algeria.
Oh, it's Algeria.
So he that is a French soldier, but an Algerian conscript.
Okay. So that reminds me of another book you might want to pick up, a very slim volume by Frantz Fanon called A Dying Colonialism, he actually touches on the question of the radio. He looks at
even the veil. There's an essay there called "Unveiling Algeria."
Absolutely. So yeah, great stuff. So much to read, especially I think in terms of really understanding the past in order to perhaps understand our future better.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Fuad. It's been a fascinating Madeka episode. We will be back next week with more on Night School. You've been listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahmat, myself, Sharad Kutin, on BFM 89.9, the business station. Okay, save.
Hold on, I got to get the screen again. All right, pause.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.